Welcome to the LGC News Roundup, the new podcast from the Local Government Chronicles news team, looking at the biggest and most significant stories of the week for councils. I'm Megan Kenyon, a reporter at LGC, and today I'm joined by Deputy News Editor Jess Hill and reporter Stephen Downs to discuss what's been happening this week.
Hi
everyone.
Hello.
Stephen, you've been reporting on what the kind of status is of the government's levelling up missions this week. Could you give us a bit of background on what you've been looking into and what your kind of thoughts are on what the news is in that area?
Yeah, sure. I mean, levelling up obviously is the buzz phrase that the government's been using pretty much on every press release for the last couple of years. But it could argue that they've got a bit unlucky that at the very time that they're trying to level up the country, they've had COVID and now the cost of living crisis and all of that happening at the that is really affecting their ability to do it, you'd imagine. And that's pretty much what the University of West London Centre for Inequality and Levelling Up is saying in a report. It's looked into hundreds of measurements of how the levelling up missions might succeed or fail. There's 12 levelling up missions, of course, which the government has, some of them about educational standards, reducing inequality, etc. And CLUP, as it shall be known, has concluded that 8 of the 12 levelling up missions are at high risk of failing. Another 2 are at medium risk of failing, which leaves only 2 that may succeed. So that would obviously be hugely worrying to the government. But you would argue that it may be more worrying to the areas that are hoping to be levelled up and hoping to have their deprivation dealt with and all of the other things that exist in their communities and a bit more equality. So that's pretty much where we are with this.
And what are the areas that are kind of most likely to fail? Where were those? You said there were 8 that are looking like they are going to fail.
Yeah, the missions related to productivity, research and development, education, health inequalities, well-being, pride of place, home ownership and crime are the ones that are seen to be at the highest risk of not achieving their targets by 2030.
And is there kind of a reason for that? Is it like funding or is it just lack of resource and things like that? Or,
well, unfortunately, it's the one thing that everything seems to be coming back to at the moment, which is the cost of living. Mm-hmm. Simply that costs are going up everywhere, everything is becoming more expensive, and as a result of that, the government's bottom line is getting a lot tighter, and it looks as though they may not be able to afford to deliver on the things that they have promised to deliver.
And Megan, you've been doing some research around investment zones this week, which would seem to contradict the government's levelling up mission, because of course any area can apply to be an investment zone, can't they? Not just those that might require the most levelling up.
Yes, so I've been looking into what the situation is with investment zones. Obviously they were announced in Kwasi Kwarteng's mini budget, and the deadline for councils to submit an expression of interest is on Friday, which means councils have basically had just 2 weeks' notice to kind of get together a proposal for what they'd like to do with investment zones, which I think is really interesting because the parameters for them are pretty unclear at the moment. I had a conversation with one Conservative councillor at the Conservative Party conference who told me that in their area, they'd been told that investment zones were kind of, there was a certain size or a certain amount of land that the government had kind of put forward as being the potential sort of area for an investment zone, but in their area they didn't have kind of a place that was that size or had that much open space or space for development in it. So I think it's super interesting that this is kind of, the government has used this as a really big flagship policy for this new administration, but the detail just isn't there. And I agree with you, Jess. I think it's interesting that kind of anyone can apply for it. The government said to us, so DLUHC, we approached them and asked for a bit more information on the investment zones. And they said that if they receive a high volume of really good applications, they will have to phase them in, which when we approached all 38 of the local authorities listed by the government as potential sites for new investment zones, pretty much all of them said they were going to submit an expression of interest. So it will be interesting to see how the government copes with that, having kind of made this promise that all these places can have investment zones. Will they be able to follow through with that? Will it be too expensive? Will it just be too much to do with the little resource that they have?
And surely if they're all going to be low tax zones, that's not going to go bode well for more for not having funding cuts in the public sector, if you're going to create so many low tax zones across the country.
Well, and you just wonder about kind of, there'll be like a big need for more infrastructure in these investment zones, and how will the government pay for that? Who's going to pay for it? How will we kind of ensure that these areas are properly set up to facilitate the low taxes and the low planning regulations that the government wants to see? Because, you know, as I said kind of last week, planning departments have been completely gutted in the past few years. So I think, yeah, I remain kind of curious about how this is all going to play out, because it is obviously an interesting policy, but it's lacking on detail, I think.
Yeah. And in the meantime, I think lots of officers who were focusing on the cost of living crisis and helping the most vulnerable residents have been diverted to working on plans, bids for investment zones, which might never go ahead.
It's a worry, isn't it? It seems to me that the last couple of years, councils have had to spend an inordinate amount of time on preparing bids for various funding pots. That's when they're not trying to get devolution through and trying to get devolved funding through. And this is yet another one. And I just wonder whether there'll be a discussion being had on this podcast in a year's time, whatever happened to investment zones. It's there seem to be at the moment, there seem to be things that are making good labels and good headlines, but perhaps we've yet to see the fruit that comes as a result of the investment. Maybe I'm being a bit cynical, but it strikes me that this is going to be yet another difficult one to be pushed through.
Well, and I think that we've seen things that are similar to the kind of premise of investment zones, like free ports and enterprise zones and things like that. So how different is this actually going to be? Is it just a repackaging of things that we've seen before, or will they genuinely kind of make a different difference, if that makes sense? Anyway, Jess, you've had a big interview published this week with Carolyn Wilkins, who is the former chief exec of Oldham, and who spent, was it 5 months working in Number 10? Could you just explain a bit more about what she did there and kind of what impact she had and how she found the transition between local and central government?
So the last time I spoke to Carolyn, I actually caught up with her while she was still chief executive of Oldham Council. That was at the beginning of the pandemic. And I remember her speaking about the frustration of feeling like local government's voice wasn't being heard by the centre at the time. And then shortly after that, she went and did an 11 months secondment as the contain director of the NHS Test and Trace programme at the height of the pandemic. And then after that, she a few months later, she spent 5 months as a senior advisor in Number 10, working on the integration white paper. I mean, she describes her time in Downing Street as being a real privilege at an extraordinary time. And it was great to hear her insights. I mean, she basically found that sense of a united voice of local government, that there's all these disjointed voices coming forward with with different priorities, and it's almost impossible to please everyone. So if you give funding pots to upper tiers, then districts complain. And one of the issues she found in public health is that public health funding has been cut so drastically that some areas it's really sparse, and they just didn't have the boots on the ground to roll out some of the test and trace initiatives as quickly as the government wanted it to. And the other thing that I learned from her was just about, she spoke about how it was harder for the centre to hear the voices of independent boroughs that are within combined authority areas. So as Oldham chief, often the government would deal directly with the mayoral combined authority of Greater Manchester, but it wouldn't necessarily hear the voices of people within those individual boroughs. And sometimes that could be frustrating. And that was quite interesting to hear that kind of different voice about the government's devolution agenda.
Did she have a solution as to how that might be improved?
So Caroline said there was a really low understanding within Whitehall of the statutory responsibilities of officers such as public health directors and chief executives. And so she's recommending that the sector should spend more time framing what responsibilities people within those roles have. So basically, so that central government has a better of understanding of the things that people within local government do.
I know Kate Josephs, who was head of the COVID task force, is obviously now the chief executive of Sheffield. And I know you've interviewed both of them. Obviously, it's different situations, but I wondered if there was a theme running through both of their experiences, having had the experience of both local and central government.
I think just having people who work in central government who've had a secondment into local government, and vice versa, people working in locally who've had that central experience, is really, really valuable, because they can offer their insights from both perspectives. So I think the more that we can do that, the more that maybe central government can offer short-term secondments into Whitehall, and councils can do the same for people within Whitehall, the better, I think, for everyone.
Brilliant. Thanks, Jess. I suppose moving on to sort of more lighthearted, well, it's maybe not really that lighthearted, but just quite a confusing but interesting story. Stephen, you were covering Canterbury's new plans.
Yeah, it's a fascinating one, and I think it is amusing. I think maybe quirky describes it as well. So I don't know how many have you both been to Canterbury? You visited?
I think I have, but I can't remember. I think I was very young.
Yeah. I think one of the things I found at Canterbury was, well, two things. Beautiful place, rammed with cars. So that's the problem that the city council is obviously trying to deal with, which is fair enough. And it's come up with a really interesting potential solution, which is based on a system that operates in Ghent in Belgium. And that is to divide the city into five zones. If you imagine the city as like a cake, it would be five slices of cake in that way. So five zones, and residents would be banned from driving directly between the zones. So if you were in zone one, and you wanted to get to somewhere in zone two, you'd either have to get public transport, walk or cycle, or if you wanted to drive, you'd have to drive out of the zone onto a new ring road, which is yet to be built, and then round the ring road as far as the next zone and drive into that zone to go where you want to go. All visitors would be banned from parking in the city. There'd be a network of new park and rides on the outskirts of each of the zones. So it's radical. Some might say it's a bit loony, but it's certainly an interesting one.
What's kind of the rationale behind this? Is it to get less people driving? Because to me, it seems as though you're going to have more people driving, maybe, or doing more driving as they have to get onto the ring road to get into the other zones.
I think the rationale behind it is A, to just take the traffic out of the centre, which it would do, and B, to make it so awkward for people to get from A to B that they have to choose alternative options. It could be quite amusing, of course, if you live in zone A and your granny lives in zone B, but they're not close enough to walk. Imagine a 2 mile journey might become a 20 mile journey to go and take some shopping to your granny. So it's little things like that. But I mean, I think there is a good rationale behind it. But the argument that opponents have said was that Ghent is a city of 4 or 5 times as many people as Canterbury. So that model is not necessarily transferable. You're not, you know, you're comparing fish with fowl. It doesn't quite work.
It'd be really interesting to go on a research trip to Ghent and speak to people who live there and find out how it works there. I'm not suggesting an LGC trip, but it would be interesting to try it out.
Any trip that would involve Belgian chips and beer sounds perfect to me. I think if I were you, I'd book it now.
Yeah, I might have some trouble getting around the city though. That's the problem.
Yeah, exactly.
Thanks so much for that, Stephen. And thank you all for listening. Remember, you can always find out more about these stories and more at lgcplus.com. And if you enjoyed listening, please like and subscribe and share. And check out our other monthly podcast, The Local Authority, which takes a more in-depth look at some of the challenges facing councils.